America Unfiltered, a fresh, raw look at U.S. politics, foreign policy, media, and culture. I'm Scott Lucas in Birmingham, England.
And I'm Liam Kennedy in Dublin, Ireland.
So, this week in America, what have we got? A surge in coronavirus with more than 136,000 now dead. We've got Black Lives Matter still pressing for recognition and action on social and economic issues. But Donald Trump is focused on pardoning his good friend, the dirty tricks operator, Roger Stone. And then there's another politician, the Democratic nominee Joe Biden, who's making his own mark with a major speech about a Green New Deal linking the environment and economic revival. Liam, what do you make of all of it?
Just another week in America. You know what? I think we need to start by, how shall I put it? We need to talk about Donald. Now, there are times when I'm very reluctant to do that, and for good reason. I think he's one huge distraction from things we should be talking about. But last week, Donald's niece, Mary Trump, published a book on his, how shall I put it, personality disorders, in the plural. She called it Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. And it's quite a read. She herself is a clinical psychologist, which seems to help in interpreting some of the things that went on in that family. She lays a lot of the reasoning about the character, the current character of the president, at the door of what she calls his sociopathic father. And she says that from there, quote, Donald began to develop powerful but primitive defenses marked by an increasing hostility to others. Now, that sounds familiar. So having read that last week, there I go, and I tune in to hear, what does the president have to say at his Rose Garden press conference on Tuesday? And as I listen to that, it turns into a 55-minute rant, free association, completely rambling, and making very, very little sense indeed. And so I think perhaps his niece was onto something. Now, to the degree that that speech, if that's what it was, made any sense at all, it was an effort to take down Joe Biden. But what was interesting is just how desperate the effort was. He was throwing everything at Biden. He's too old. He's becoming senile. He's a socialist. He loves China. But the more he said about those things, the more you fail to believe anything. And it occurred to me that Trump is getting somewhat desperate. He's failing to persuade voters to hate Biden. He's got a problem, Scott.
So is it a political desperation? Because he's about 10% down in the polls. He's behind in the key swing states. At the same time, we're still 4 months before the election. So political desperation or personal desperation? Is it simply that he doesn't feel loved because of coronavirus and the economy?
He doesn't feel loved. Well, that's what his niece says. He doesn't feel loved. But he feels hostility in place of it. And that hostility goes out to others. He does need love. She points that out as well. But we know that. And that's what he gets from those campaign rallies that he gives. But those haven't been going so well, as you know. In fact, the last one of those had a very small audience. And it's rumored that the one he canceled recently had a lot to do with the fact that it might have been even smaller. So the love has not been felt. And when you say, is it the personal or the political, it's all one to Trump. He's living inside that bubble that's called Donald, and he's not feeling the love, and he's lashing out. And at the minute, I think he is very confused, and he is feeling more and more desperate. And of course, what he's doing is he's knuckling down, and he's pushing toward his base. And that means that he is playing very heavily into the culture wars, and that means he's playing very heavily on the race card.
Why not play nice and try to make friends if he wants to be loved? I mean, in the past 48 hours, what we've seen is a stepping up of the attacks on the White House's chief corona advisor, you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci. You know, why try to take down the guy who should be key to your effort to show leadership? And for once, Donald, try to be friendly instead of trying to be a bully.
Yeah, it seems he did have an effort at pulling Fauci down, but he seem to be stepping back from it a little bit as well. You get the impression that some of Trump's surrogates were asked to go out, take a pitch at Fauci, but Fauci's popularity is a lot stronger than Donald's is. So I think he's backed off that. It's what I mean when he's trying a lot of things at the minute. They don't seem to be working for him. He's going through a very bad patch.
Let's look at Biden, right? You know, Biden, who has been more visible than the Trump people say he has been. He hasn't been hiding in the basement, but he really steps it up this week with this idea of a $2 trillion investment in a green economy. So you can have both action against climate change to be environmentally responsible, and you can also give a boost to the economy coming out of the pandemic. Is it working?
I don't know. I think it's too soon to say. One of the things I'm really intrigued about with Biden is his figures are so far ahead. He's been very quiet. What happens now when he starts to talk? I mean, clearly Trump's people are going to be all over this. They're looking for weaknesses. They're looking for angles. They haven't found them yet. I think it's intriguing that Biden's policy agenda is arguably more progressive than Obama's. This is really interesting. You know, he is really pushing out there in a way that I didn't think was possible with Joe Biden. So I don't think it's a question that he's sitting still and doing nothing. I think he is starting finally to test the water and policy. And I think that the left wing of the Democratic Party is getting a little bit of a voice there. This is interesting. I think he's trying to hold on to as many parts of that very complex open party as he can.
So he's moving towards Elizabeth Warren. He's moving towards Bernie Sanders the way they ran, which points to attempted Democratic unity, but also indicates that they feel like the attacks on Sanders, the attacks on Warren, the attacks on the extremist by Trump aren't landing if he's going to make that move. Rather than distancing himself from the so-called progressives.
Yeah, I think this is what we're sensing, and it's still unclear. I mean, I threw into that the polling around Black Lives Matters recently, and I only mention that because it seems there's a sea change in how Americans are viewing some of the most fundamental matters about what it means to be American at this point in time. I mean, I've rarely seen this in my lifetime. I think there is fundamental change going on in the United States, and I think that Trump has lost control of this narrative. I'm not sure where it's going myself, but it looks like he was not going to be around in November if it keeps going as it's moving at the minute.
All right, but let's take it beyond how Americans are viewing it. How is America being viewed across the Atlantic, say in Ireland?
Well, the transatlantic views are intriguing. Now, if you take them at one level, let's say the political elites and the policy elites, they're incredibly nervous because they buy into the idea of a transatlantic relationship. But that relationship is almost moribund. I mean, it had shifted years ago. Trump has just put a lot of final nails in that coffin. But if you're talking about the transatlantic relationship more in terms of, well, how do people in Europe feel about America now? That too has moved. And I think it's moved in a way that's also quite profound. In Ireland, which you mentioned, you know, we have a very powerful relationship with the United States. The English like to talk of a special relationship. We think ours is exceptional as well as special, and it's very old. You know, there's 34.5 million people in the United States claiming Irish heritage. That's a strong personal, cultural, and historical relationship, but it's very uneasy today. Now, a lot of that has to do with Trump, but I don't think it's exclusively that. I think that Irish people, like many Europeans, and by the way, Ireland is still in Europe, are looking across the water, and they don't see the country that they saw when they were younger, or the country that they were told about when they were younger. They see a country that appears to be in decline, a country that has given up on global leadership. I think Ireland, like a lot of Europe, shared in a fantasy that really began in the middle of the 20th century, but that fantasy is in trouble. And the fantasy was that the United States represented a liberal and redemptive power that was there to save all of us if we needed it. I don't think we buy into that fantasy anymore.
To find out more about this, I turned to a good friend, activist, writer, Tori Eggerman, who has been involved in projects such as Storytelling for Advocacy, such as the civil society organization Arsis Avam, which is Persian for Third Sphere. Why Tori Eggerman? Well, in addition to being an extraordinary in both her writing and in her engagement with a cross-section of people, she has lived in Iran for several years as an American Jewish woman in the Islamic Republic. And then recently, she has been in the Netherlands, where she still lives in Amsterdam with her Iranian partner. And she has viewed how the Dutch debate on race, culture, society has been inflected by the Black Lives Matter moment, but arguably has gone beyond it, putting America to the side. How is life in Amsterdam right now?
Life is good. We got our COVID numbers yesterday, which had not gone up for Amsterdam, which is kind of miraculous. I'm not sure how we're managing to be so safe, because it doesn't seem to me like people are wearing masks or anything like that. But I guess since there was never really a breakout here as extreme as in other places in the Netherlands, that just kind of dodged a bullet so far.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, before talking about you personally, I mean, you've just mentioned coronavirus here. I mean, in the Netherlands, while looking at what's happening amongst yourselves, are people looking back across at the states? And is that affecting the way that they view America?
You know, I don't know, because really the people I speak to are expats. And what I about this, because the Dutch people I speak to seem to think and that they live in a little bubble where the impact of other countries doesn't really affect them. So they look at the US and they don't think, oh, that could happen here if we, you know, let this get out of control. They just think we're doing things right. No matter what they're doing them right. And so I think that people who are not native Dutch people are more concerned than a lot of Dutch people and take the virus a lot more seriously. And in fact, my own doctor has confirmed this, that her patients who are not Dutch born are taking the virus much more seriously than her Dutch patients.
My son is in Leiden, not too far from where you are right now. And he's saying the same thing, that life sort of goes on for the Dutch.
I have a theory, which goes for the Dutch, actually, and Sweden, and possibly the UK and America. Is this, but really, definitely the Netherlands and Sweden just seem to have this attitude that I think is really rooted in white supremacism, that, you know, they see themselves as white. And that's how they see themselves, whether they admit it or not. And they see themselves as being stronger, healthier, and, you know, more resistant to these things than other people. So, of course, the policies of other countries would not necessarily apply to them.
Now that's interesting because, I mean, my image, you know, when you think of the Netherlands, we think of like this liberal bastion, and therefore we think a lot about supposedly tolerance. But you've already brought in the white supremacy phrase already. Are you saying, in fact, that there is this problematic approach by the Dutch towards race? Is that like open every day, or is it more of a unspoken that's throughout Dutch society?
It's getting more and more spoken. So, and I think the Black Lives Matter movement has really, really brought the notion of racism in the Netherlands to the attention of most non-Black Dutch people. So I think for the first time, many people here are looking at it and seeing that, yes, there is racism in our society. And they're admitting it. It's the first time since I've lived here that I've heard people, white people, talk about it.
So in that sense, I mean, so the response after the murder of George Floyd was a catalyst, at least in the elevation of BLM in discussion in the Netherlands. But when they discuss BLM, are they taking, quote, lessons from America or images from America? Or is this discussion then becoming very Dutch, the way that they're looking at local resonances?
They're looking at themselves.
Okay.
So this is a real breakthrough moment, I feel, here, that there is some inward looking. Because before, and still, I would say, this still exists. There are a lot of people who refuse to see it, refuse to understand what racism is, insist that even looking at race is racist. But that's changing. And people are starting to understand the impact that certain, you know, traditions have on people who are not white and in the society. And of course, we can think of one really specific one, which is this blackface character that comes around Christmas time here, early December, actually.
So this is Black Pete.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Or in Dutch, it's pronounced
Zwarte Piet.
Zwarte Piet. So
yes.
Zwarte Piet, as I recall it, the historical context of this is that he was in one of the Dutch courts several hundred years ago, was brought across, I believe, from the Dutch colonies in the Americas. Is that right? Or was it the Dutch colonies in Africa?
Well, the costume that he wears is from these two children who were enslaved here in the Netherlands and were part of the court, and they wore these, you know, courtly costumes. But the actual tradition of blackface, which most Dutch people don't realize, actually comes from the American minstrel show. They didn't do it before that. So
they took a Dutch story, which is intersected with the story of slavery, and the Dutch were involved in slavery up until the 17th century.
Yeah.
And then they impose the American image of blackface, the American culture of blackface, and get superimposed on it.
Well, yeah.
That's really interesting. All right. So you said that, is there therefore an interrogation now of race and culture, which is including Black Pete? People are saying that.
Definitely.
Does that mean no more Black Pete this Christmas?
In most places, no, there won't be any more. But there are still places where there are a lot of holdouts. And the more you tell them that it's racist, the more they want to do it. And the more aggressive it becomes.
You're kind of an exemplar of America Unfiltered in the world because, the child of Eastern European ancestry, but growing up in Indiana, Illinois, but then part of your life spent in Iran, and then much of your life now spent in Europe, specifically in the Netherlands. So in this personal journey, has America been a marker as you've moved along, a marker not only for you, but those you've interacted with? And if it's been a marker, has it been a positive or a negative? And is that receding now? You know, is, quote, American influence receding?
In my life, America has always been a kind of marker. It's my grandparents who were born in Eastern Europe. And because I'm old and I was growing up during the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement, I had such a tumultuous relationship with America. And then I would be with my grandmother or my great aunts, my great uncles, my grandfather. And I would try and express this, but, you know, I was a child and I would try to express my discomfort. And for them, America was the Garden of Eden. They called it Gan Eden, you know, and everything about it was wonderful. They loved the country so much that they actually gave up their native languages, you know? And I, in a way, I'm like this typical immigrant grandchild where, you know, like, I want to know more about the culture they came from. They don't want to talk about it because for them, it's all trauma.
And specifically, where did they come from in Eastern Europe?
Poland, Lithuania, Romania, and maybe now recently we have discovered that my grandmother, who we thought was Russian or came from Vienna. She was a baby, but you know, they had even forgotten where they came from.
So all of that is sort of, if not buried, pushed to the side. You're even as a child trying to recuperate it. I mean, are you able to recuperate it in America, or is it the sense that you actually recuperate more of being an American once you're outside of the country?
Partly when you're outside the country, it becomes very clear what it means to be American because you are American in other people's eyes. So people start to see you this way and you really understand the difference. And I've been through ups and downs with my relationship with my American identity and have written about it in the past because it did. The relationship I think that a lot of American Jews have with America is very complicated because, yes, America saved our lives. I mean, without it, we would be dead. There's no question that my family would no longer exist. No question at all. Like, that is a given. And so there's this kind of tendency to feel, and I think most immigrants or many immigrants may feel this. You come to a country and it's like you don't feel that you inherit its history. You feel like you are making a new history for it. So the history of slavery, the history of genocide against Native Americans, the history of, you know, land grab, you didn't inherit that. You come in after that. So in a way, it makes you feel innocent of these things. And I think that one thing that I've come to over the past decade of thinking about my relationship to America is understanding that the history of slavery and the history of, you know, stealing land from the native people and murdering them and all these things, these are also my history. I am not innocent because my relatives came later. So this is a very complicated idea for, I think, a lot of immigrant groups to understand and to understand how they interact with the politics of the country and the rights of others. For me, a lot of that understanding came through looking at the Black Lives Matter movement and looking at these new demonstrations and trying to really understand and come to terms with my complicity in these things, which may sound extreme because how am I complicit? But I am. I am. I'm complicit because I benefit. I do benefit from having white skin. Everyone does, whether we want to or not. And I benefit from the fact that, you know, I think a lot, and I think something that people don't understand is like when I was young in America, it was clear to most other Americans that I was not white, which just seems bizarre now. I look at myself and I'm like, how can people think that? You know, like it was clear to them that I was Jewish. And I want to say that I had blonde hair. I mean, yeah, that's also hard to believe, but my hair was blonde, but there was something in my facial structure or something in the way I talked or something in the way I moved where no matter where I was, people knew I was not like your white bread American. And I can't understand it now because it seems so foreign to me now, this notion that people could see me as Jewish. And I think that has a lot to do with immigration from the Middle East in a lot of countries, because now, you know, I don't look that different. And I don't, it's not that I look Middle Eastern, it's just that my looks are no longer so different from other people's. And that's a strange thing to come, that's a strange thing to remember. To remember that people used to look at me and see a Jewish person without any other markers.
So if I've got this right, whiteness, in fact, even whiteness is a complex notion in itself when you're growing up in the States, because it's not just skin color, it's also the manner of speech, it's also certain cultural markers that you have. So it intersects with religion, possibly intersects with class in certain places as well. But still, you have this sense of white privilege even when you're not being considered white growing up. Okay. Yeah. All right. So you've got this complexity that you say that you have to, and you worked through it in recent years. But before recent years, everything in this white complex Tori Eggerman goes to Iran.
Yeah.
Okay. And when, what year did you go?
2003.
So this is the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yes.
You marry an Iranian.
Yes. But before that.
Before that. So you and your Iranian partner back into the Islamic Republic.
Yeah.
So how are you being negotiated in this country, which for many Americans is just a caricature of the other?
It was like being a celebrity. In a weird way, like because I looked different and everybody was interested in me, especially when they found out that I was American. They immediately thought I was Russian, usually, or Turkish, Russian or Turkish. That was what I got usually. And in sometimes people thought I was Kurdish, which I don't understand. But, you know, rarely did they think I was American, because who would believe that there would be an American in Iran? And not only that, you know, like if they found I was Jewish, who would believe that there would be an American Jew in Iran? I'm not the only one, I tell you, but, you know, that was a story. So I even was in a shared cab once where they asked me where I was from. I told them I was American, and they didn't know I could speak Persian as well as I could. And so the whole conversation is like, no way is she American. Americans are too terrified to come here. If she was American, she'd be so scared. She would never get in a shared cab. They went on and on and on. And I finally started talking to them, and they just like, they started laughing so hard they couldn't believe that I could understand what they were saying. And then I got this whole thing like, you know, the amazing thing about being in Iran as an American is that most Iranians know so much more about America than we know about Iran. So they know about American politics. They know the names of American politicians, something most Americans don't know. Like, you know, they can talk about these things. Like at that time, when I was in the cab specifically, they were talking about Condoleezza Rice and how she had had an Iranian boyfriend, and that's why she didn't like Iran. She was trying to get back at Iran for the things this man had done to her. So, I mean, like these whole complex, there's just like this complex storytelling culture. And I feel like in one weird way, I was super privileged in Iran. I mean, because I'm white, because I'm Western, because I'm American, and because I'm a woman, which is shocking for people to hear. But as a Western woman, you know, I just had access to everyone. Everyone would talk to me, and I could talk to all the women. I could talk to all the men. It was no big deal. And so I had a very strange experience there, which is this experience of being seen and spoken to and, you know, losing things that I had had before, which was I was so shy before. And, you know, I tell people all the time, if Iranians ask me, if I was in an arena and there were 100,000 people there and they were all Iranian and they just called me out of the audience and said, would you sing for us? I would say yes, even though I can't sing, because I know that's what they want me to do. You know, I mean, just ridiculous things like that. But I also had the experience of, for the first time in my life, having to watch myself, having to watch my language, how I dressed, how I appeared, if I laughed, if I did all sorts of things. And that experience of having to watch myself, not just in public, but in private, because, you know, who knows who's watching you in private, was the most stressful experience of my entire life. It made me feel like, you know, Porky Pig with smoke coming out of his ears. I often felt that feeling of having smoke come out of my ears from all the things I wasn't saying and all the ways I was controlling myself. And I feel like it aged me. It made me depressed for the very first time in my entire life. And it made me really understand what it means. It's a fraction of what it means to be an oppressed minority anywhere else. But I understand that this is not something that is in your control. This feeling of being watched all the time, of having to watch yourself all the time, is something that causes mental problems. It causes physical problems. And I had those things. I did become, I'm not at all a suicidal person. And I had thoughts of suicide. I had never in my life felt even remotely depressed. And I became depressed. And I aged faster. I was aging faster than I had ever aged before.
So you're both privileged but constrained the same
yes.
point. So it's not a privileged position that takes you beyond the pressure. You actually have more pressure put on you.
Yeah.
Did they look at, I mean, because you're sort of the American exotic there.
Right, exactly.
But are they looking at you as the American exotic who is a representative of America, or as someone who stood apart from America because you were different?
These are two good questions, and I think they're both true. Which is, you're at once representative, and then you hear all the time, you're not like other Americans. Or, you know, I mean, which is the most backhanded compliment you could possibly get. But, you know, I hear it all the time, and I really don't like it. I hear also, you're not like other Jewish people. You're not like other Americans.
So in other words, for you to have an identity, you still have to have part of your identity, as it were, pushed to the side. Iran today, to bring it back around to Black Lives Matter, where we start, is using the icon of America in a different way. So the Supreme Leader, state media, to an extent, President Rouhani, it's all about how Black Lives Matter has exposed the racist America. It's exposed how the American exceptionalism is an exceptionalism which is of evil. That, of course, is inflicted upon Iran. So clearly, they're trying to turn American values back upon itself. But both being inside Iran and still active in trying to influence Iran. Does that mean for you that there still is a place for American values, or at least values that Americans would hope to espouse, as going beyond America and being able to influence a place like Iran?
There is only one thing now that America can do to influence Iran in any positive way, and that is to work on itself. This is the only thing left. Work on, eliminating execution, not in fact making execution possible at the federal level again, but actually eliminating it completely from American society. That will influence Iran more than anything else. Look at the Black Lives Matter protests and get into negotiation with people, improve the situation that many poor and Black people are living in, and that will influence Iran. The only influence we have left, from a moral point of view, is to work on ourselves. That's it. I'm sorry to say, a lot of us in the diaspora, a lot of Iranians are doing really great work. And it's really impressive. And a lot of American Iranians are doing really great work. But now how can it work if America refuses to stand by its own values, if it refuses to be its best self?
Because we got this weird juxtaposition that Iran has just confirmed the death sentences on three protesters from the November mass demonstrations. And Amnesty International, quite rightly, has come out and condemned it. But as you point out, America carried out its first federal execution in 17 years after the Supreme Court votes 5-4 to allow it to happen. In a sense, it's that tension in America between value and practice. Does that mean, as an American who's seeing this negotiated abroad, that you continue to hang on to the possibility of America working through these problems? Or does it mean that you finally, having had to deal with this for decades, does it mean you finally push America to the side and say, look, fine, whatever is positive coming out of America, we just can't rely on that. It now has to be us in the Netherlands or in Iran, almost separated from that country where we grew up.
I am the most pessimistic person I know, so I don't want to answer these questions. But I do feel that a better America is possible.
For the sake of our listeners, I'll take the optimism, and I'm especially optimistic now because I've had the chance to talk to you, work through this. You could do this all day, but thank you for this podcast. I look forward to seeing you very soon in our next venture. But right now, just stay safe, stay sane, stay decent.
Well, thank you, Scott.